pleasure to see familiar faces in the audience. It's always a pleasure to be back here in London. I don't get to that many opportunities. So I'm actually going to ask you for help here tonight, because I think everyone has been in a relationship of love, whether it's love for Torah learning, love for our Creator, love for another person in our lives, a spouse, a child, love for ourselves, love for art, for music, for soccer. There are so many different areas that we can apply this word. I think you will agree that often, if this word love is going to be thrown about in many different contexts, I love my dog, I love my mother-in-law, hopefully it's not the same love. No, I use the word love in so many different ways. Is it possible it starts to lose its preciousness? So, we really want to, number one, have a working definition for love. Unless it can't be defined. And maybe it can't be defined. Maybe it's an emotion that is so complex that we really can't get to grips with it. And perhaps that's why it is so elusive, that many of us don't feel that there's enough love on a consistent basis in our lives. So we do want, if there is a way, to identify a real working definition for love. And if there is, where are we going to get clarity on that subject? Should it be the media? Should it be literature? Should it be musical lyrics? There are many attempts in history of great minds in theatre, in literature, in music, to capture what is it that love is that turns us on in order to help us experience love more in our lives. So we're going to try and figure out where we're going to search for clarity on this very important subject. Another area which I want to touch upon, and I'm kind of giving away up front the real punchline, is that love is a science. And what do I mean by that? You can put it under the microscope and identify what are the specific ingredients, if you like, the emotional molecular structure that equals what we call love. That essentially love is not an emotion. Now, that's a very difficult claim to make, but that's the point I'm going to be reinforcing tonight. Love is not an emotion. It is a scientific formula that when we play out the ingredients, the mechanics that create this result, then love is what we experience. The emotion we call love is the result of a very specific formula. And it's not something that's hairy-fairy in the skies. And I think the greatest proof, if I'm allowed to use this word, which is the underlying predicate of this statement, that love is really a science, is the following. God commands love. How can you command me to love you? You know, there are some people that in certain moments in my life, I positively do not love you, and now God is commanding me, I still have to love you. I hate you right now. I really resent you, so you cannot believe how much I really am hurt by you and what you've done to me. That how can God just tell me, no, press this button called love, and I've got to feel it towards you. Maybe I don't feel it towards you right now. So how can God command me? Not just once. He commands me to love him. Deuteronomy 6, we say it every day in the famous mission statement of the Jewish people, Shema Israel. We say, love God with all your heart, all your thoughts, all your soul, even when he takes our soul away, I'm still going to love him. U'b'chol me'odecha, and with all my possessions, all my money, all my talents. The word me'od is the same letters as Adam, says the Shlach HaKadosh, that means all my talents that you created me with, I love you with. I'm going to use my musical talents, writing talents, whatever talents we have. And another meaning in the word b'chol me'odecha, to love God with all our me'od, is b'chol mida u'mida. Every measure that God measures out to a person, where there's obviously a blessing in life, good marriage, happy children, health, wealth, or God is exacting payment from me for things that I have to pay for. Whatever I go through in life, be very, very grateful. Wow, that's a tall expectation. That I'm practicing every day a statement that essentially declares, I will love you, God, no matter what. How can God demand that of me? How can he command me to just have that? Someone comes out of the camps after the Holocaust, and he says these words, I may not feel like saying, God, I love you with all my life, all my heart, all my soul, all my might. Because look what you've done. Look what you took away from me. How can God command love? You hear the problem? Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. I'm commanded to love other people like I love myself. But what happens if I hate myself? How much do I have to love you? What happens if I'm suicidal? How much do I have to love you now? Now, I had a friend once came out of the 26th story. There was a rope tied to the door right next to the elevator. Went all the way to the end of the corridor. And there was a gentleman who was tying a rope around his waist. And then he started hanging himself out the window. So I went up to the guy and said, excuse me, what are you doing? He said, I'm trying to commit suicide. I said, look, no, I don't want to interfere with your free will, but let me give you an education. You're supposed to put the rope around your neck. He said, I tried that, but I couldn't breathe. Suicide is a very serious matter. You know, in Genesis chapter 9, we're told that taking my life is equivalent to murder. What's the difference between taking someone else's life or taking my own? They're both acts of removal of a person from this world. So suicide is very serious. But if I take God's words literally, love your neighbor like yourself. If I were suicidal, I could kill my neighbor in the name of loving him like I love myself. So what does God mean by that? And how can he command me to love someone like I love myself? I don't brush anyone else's teeth. I only brush mine. I'm supposed to love. What am I supposed to do to love another person like I love myself? So these are some of the questions we want to address tonight. Can love be redefined? And how does God command it? And where are we supposed to go for clarity on this very important subject? Now, I have to be honest with you, I would like to dedicate this evening's presentation to Ringo Starr. And the reason why is because I was about 16 years old when I walked into school late one morning, used to come early every morning to play soccer, my favorite sport still is. And at that time, Ringo had his young son, Zach, 4-year-old, cute little boy. He was in school. Actually, Zach is quite famous today. He's been out of prisons and rehabs across America. But at that time, he was a cute 4-year-old. And Ringo walks into school, dragging his feet along the floor, wearing a dirty, smelly sheepskin coat. And he comes out with his bright green Rolls Royce, ruined the Rolls Royce. And I go up to Ringo's dad and say, Ringo, can I have your autograph? And he said two words to me. The second word was off. And the first word contained four letters, and it wasn't love. And it really got me thinking, seriously, got me thinking. Here's a guy, he's drumming away, love is all you need, yeah. You don't know the first thing of decency. Tell me that your therapist and your agent has told you your entire career is in your wrist, so you can't write all these autographs. But how do you come up just saying those two words? You know what, I really should say in his defense that about 2 years ago, in People's Magazine, so a magazine in America comes out and talks about all the gossip of other people and celebrities. I don't get the magazine, someone showed it to me. And there was an article about Ringo Starr's apology to the public. After 40 years, he said, I'm apologizing to tens of thousands of fans for the past 40 years that I have verbally abused, including family and friends. And his excuse was, number one, he was depressed because he was on drugs. And number two, he was depressed because he was on control drugs. Now, here's the person that's drumming away, love is all you need. Where am I supposed to go for clarity on this subject? Seriously. Let me ask you, Shakespeare, would you agree Shakespeare has incredible insights in the dynamics of human beings, men, women, true or false?
True.
Absolutely true. And if you had to select any one of his plays that might possibly give us the most clarity on love, which play would you probably identify? Romeo and Juliet. And if you can't have the one you love, what should you do? Now, there have been songs that have been written that reflect this idea. I can't live without you. I can't live... What are the lyrics saying? What are the lyrics essentially saying? Who do I really love? In those lyrics. In Shakespeare's statement. I'm not saying Shakespeare was trying to teach us what to do if the person we want to marry is not there, we should commit suicide. I don't think he was trying to say that. But as an option, which obviously it is, an option, is that something I want to teach myself as part of clarity on love? I mean, there are 6 billion people on this planet. Okay, we're Jewish, so there's only 18 million, so that's takes care of that. You've got 9 million other choices to choose from. Should I take my life because I can't have the person I love? When we hear music that essentially says, I love you, or I love the way you wear your jeans, or I can't live without you, what am I really saying? What is the message in that lyric? Who do I really love in that lyric? Is it you that I love, or is it really me?
Yourself.
It's really myself.
Yeah.
That I can't live without you. So I'm not talking about how I want to grow with you and what I want to do to enhance the relationship that I want to give. I'm talking about my loss if you're not in my... Can I continue without you? Should I continue living without you? There used to be a movie, I think some of the people in this room might remember it, Love Story. Remember Love Story? Do you remember? Here you got like the ideal situation of a man and woman, emotionally intimate, and they fall in love, they get married, and then she gets cancer and dies. And you see him walking through the snow at the end of the movie with a signature tune going across the screen, and he's in total depression. Now, depression is an option. But where am I supposed to go for real clarity on this important subject? So, to help understand this, let's go in different levels. Number one, if I love another person for the shape of their body, for their clothes, wow, you look so good in those jeans, what level of love am I describing here? Is it an internal or an external level? Obviously, it's an external level of love. It's not. We're not getting to the real person. Do you agree? You know, in Hebrew, what's the word for clothing? Beggar. You know, in America, I think you might have this expression here. The clothes makes the man. Do you have that expression here?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Isn't that Shakespeare originally, I think?
Oh, yes?
Maketh the man.
Yeah. Oh, maketh the man? Okay. I wonder if you got permission on that. All right. The clothes makes the man. Here's my question to you. What's the word in Hebrew for clothing?
Beged.
This three-letter root, beged, shares the exact same word, boged. What does boged mean?
Betrayal.
Betrayal. Traitor. God has unlimited imagination. So why doesn't he have one word for clothing and a separate word for betrayal? Why does one word share the exact same root as both? Clothing and betrayal.
Covers up and betrays the...
My clothing
can betray the...
Can really betray who I really am.
It could reveal,
it could be a statement, but it's essentially a betrayal of the true essence of who I am. I am not my clothes. I am not my car. I am not my postal code. I am not my house. I am not my yacht. I am not my second home. I'm not even my family. Who is the real me that we want to understand what's real in love? When is love really real? So let me share with you the following. If we fall in love with something external, we know it has only temporary value. It's not going to be consistent. People's money. If I respect someone for their money, that's not consistent, because the moment they lose the money, I lose respect for that person. That's not intrinsic love. We know that's not real. It's a love, but it's not real. It's not real in the sense of long-lasting, deep, honest, intrinsic. So let's try and identify what is real love. Any suggestions?
Love, real love is when you love someone for who they are and not what they are.
Okay, for who they are and not what they are?
As in if you love someone because they're rich or because they're attractive, that's not your love, because, you know...
Okay, not because of their identity,
but you
externally.
Love them because they have time, because they're so...
Okay, so even though I may be enamored by the letters at the end of their name, and I know it, and I'm turned on by the fact that you're so intelligent and very intellectual, or that you're so well-read, or that you've got social status or financial status, but my real love for you is based upon who you are as a person, so that's much more long-lasting. So all the other types of love are still good. They're not negatives necessarily. They're bonuses. Any other suggestions? What is real love? When is love real? Yes, sir?
You can ask me without conditions, unconditional love.
Okay, we can talk about unconditional love. That I'm going to love you, not based upon your performance. That even when you mess up, I will still love you. What will help me stay in love with you, even when you break expectations in my mind of who you are? or what you're supposed to do. What happens if you disappoint me in the way you raise the children or run the finances? And I need unconditional love. We've got to try and understand, what does that term really mean? What does unconditional love really mean? We're going to try and get to it.
In some other area, then.
Sorry?
If you disappoint in one area, that depresses you something.
Okay. So what's the something? We've got to identify what that something is. What is that thing? Yes, sir.
Some kind of good
thing. I think when you're at that level of love, it's a spiritual love. Whether you're not loving the physical actions, the manifestations in this world, but if it's, you're talking about a partner, you're talking about a love that goes beyond the physical, something so deep that even whatever happens to occur in this world, that's not negating the love.
Okay, I think we're getting hot, warmer over here. Let's look at it this way. How does God love us? Is it conditional? So how long does he wait for me to become the best I can become? What's the expiry date that a person essentially has? 120 years. What's God waiting for us to do? That even if I mess up 100,000 times this week, why does God still love me? And what's the proof? When I wake up the next morning, why is that proof that God still loves me?
I didn't pass away
during the night. When I went to bed last night, did I have a contract with God? I didn't have a contract. So the fact that I woke up is the biggest proof that he hasn't given up hope that I can still accomplish whatever I'm in this world to accomplish. So if God hasn't given up hope in me, how much more so I shouldn't give up hope in me? So God is saying to me, he loves me every single day just for the fact of waking up. In fact, one of the first two words a Jew says, Modeh Ani. How do we translate the word Modeh Ani? I thank you. I am a thank you. My business in this world is to be an appreciator, a grateful person. Why? We talked about this a little bit last night. Because what is gratitude, essentially? Acknowledgement of what?
Acknowledgement that somebody else did something, you didn't do it.
That I received something, it's a debt. Yeah. In fact, the word for gratitude in Hebrew, hoda'a, shares the exact same root as vidui. Vidui means admission. Why does the word admission in Hebrew share the same root as gratitude? Because what is gratitude? It's an admission that there's good in my life. That I'm the receiver of good, and for that I'm grateful. So I owe a debt of gratitude for what's good in my life. We're getting closer. Let me share with you the following. What is the greatest compliment one person can give another person? Either parent to child, or a spouse to another spouse?
Appreciation.
For what?
I like you the way you are.
I like you the way you are. That's a very powerful one. And therefore, any improvement you make upon that is all bonus. But I already like you the way you are. What will then happen if, or rather when, you make mistakes? How will I stay in love with you even when you make mistakes? What good am I going to be able to focus on that is so overpowering that even when you mess up, it will not take away my love for you, my appreciation for you? Okay, getting very warm. I think this is very, very powerful. Look again at the love relationship of God and men. Why does God tolerate so many mistakes? What's that based upon? God giving up? Oh, you know, just let him just make all the mistakes he wants. Or is God trusting that I have the ability to change myself? That even if I mess up a few hundred thousand times this week, I can still, maybe one day, wake up and realize the mistake I made. And then instead of beating myself up about the ex-marriage, and now I'm on my second or third, instead of beating myself up about my mistakes, I just take whatever I can learn from where I messed up and move myself forward. So instead of the mistake hurting me, it makes me stronger. We're getting a little bit closer. When is... Yeah?
No, just sort of go back to what you said before. I think if when your spouse or whoever makes a mistake or... Or you know, love giving or love or giving shouldn't be conditional, because obviously emunah, obviously as the rabbis say, not, you know, people translate it as faith, but it's faithfulness. So it's not just I believe in you. It's basically saying I'm going to give to you. I've established, you know, once you get married, you establish a relationship with someone. It's not a case of, you know, it's, not that this is a Jewish thing, but you know, they say in sickness and in health, it's not just, you know, if you earn lots of money and cook me nice meals, I'll give back to you. You have to give to them.
Okay.
Anyway,
okay. So what we're trying to identify is here, what is it about that other person I'm going to continue giving to, even when you're not necessarily fulfilling my expectations of what you have to do to give to me? So I'm going to move forward a little bit over here. If you still have questions, I'm going to ask you to, you can put your hand up just a few minutes. Let me move on to this point over here. We're talking about identifying virtue in another person. In the world we live in today, would you say that love is simple or complex? What would you say? I think we agree. The way we see love today is essentially complex. What I'm suggesting tonight is that the science of love is a formula that is so deceptively simple that it's right in front of my eyes most of the time. And here's the formula. We're looking for a definition that works in every love relationship. It explains the mechanic of where love is turned on, whether it's love for a dog or my mother-in-law, or food or sports, or whether it's love for art or chocolate. It makes no difference what area it is. It works every time. This definition works every time. The greatest compliment we can pay another person essentially is to say, I recognize you exist in my life, and I'm happy you exist in my life. Now, the question is, who is the you that I'm saying I recognize? Which part of you? The shape of your body? Your social status? Your financial status? All that I could be impressed, enamored by. Your intellectual ability, your accomplishments, what you've done for the world, your contribution. But the real you has not yet been touched. It's nowhere close to the real you. You know, I think the one profession in world history that gets the most recognition, accolades, and admiration for who they are, not actors and actresses, get the most recognition and admiration for who they are, not. Think about it. If you met a Tom Hanks tonight, how would you respond to this person? As a real person or as a screenplay? How he is on screen. Oh my God, is that Tom Hanks? I can't believe it's really, it's amazing. I'm in the same room as you. Oh, it's all your movies. You are amazing. How will we relate? How do you think 99% of people who encounter a famous person, be they an actor or an actress, be they a musician, a rock star, a sports player, how do we respond to these people? As real people or as the persona on screen and in their talent? But here's the problem, you see. If they are receiving recognition for who they are not, the vast majority of the time, could that explain why these people, in our minds, I would say, if I had that person's fame, if I had that person's looks, I would feel so good about myself. And yet, in reality, what is the truth about these people? Are they mostly very happy people? Or mostly very unhappy people? I'm asking you honestly. I'll never forget the school I was in. I went to visit it today. King Arthur's School, North End Road. I was there for 14 years. And in my class, there was Peter Sellers' son. Peter Sellers' son was Michael Sellers. Unfortunately, I heard he died just a few months ago. I was shocked. But Peter Sellers, most of you have heard of him, I assume, in Pink Panther. Peter Sellers, he died not of heart attack, as the media claimed. He died of an overdose of heroin. Peter Sellers, unfortunately, was a very, very unhappy person. On his third marriage, after he died, he left in his will £3 million, which 30 years ago was a lot of money, for his third wife, and £800 for his son Michael. And he said in his will, damn you, make a life for yourself. What does that say about a love relationship between a parent and a child? I'll never forget Elizabeth Taylor. My father was working with her on a movie once where she had to be called in. She had laryngitis during the film, and so she had to mouth the words, but she didn't have a voice. So she was flown in from America to London, where my father directed the revoicing of the movie. She had to then redo her part on the soundtrack to match the words to the mouth movements. It's called dubbing, revoicing. and she was carried into the Dublin Theatre an hour after it was already booked. It was like $1,000 an hour. This was many years ago. And she was carried in by the porter of the Ritz Hotel, who explained that she'd been ordering drinks the whole night after she got off the phone with Richard Burton, who at the time she was on her second marriage with him. Here's a person who is out of control. Now, I don't want to put down Elizabeth Taylor, but I'm asking you honestly, if she was speaking tonight on When Is Love Real, how many people do you think there would be in this room? She's adored. Am I exaggerating? She's adored by tens of millions of people. And yet in an interview a couple of years ago, and then again, it's not to put it down, I'm just sharing with you how difficult these people's lives are and how confusing the whole arena of love becomes when we see that these are, so to speak, idols that our children are taught almost to admire, and yet in reality their lives are saturated with pain. How many times was Elizabeth Taylor married, you know? It was eight times. She married eight times. Now you might not want to count, she both married three times or whatever. Two of them died on her, but she's married eight times. So do you think she has a lot to say on the subject of love? Would you agree? 2 years ago, when she had a successful tumor removed from her head, she was asked in an exclusive interview, what do you think of Sean Connery? Do you know what her answer was? Sean Connery can put his slippers beneath my bed any night of the week. Is Mrs. Sean Connery in the room? Oh, good, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask you honestly, what is loyalty on a 0 to 10 scale? What would loyalty score on a 0 to 10 scale in marriage? What would it score?
10.
10. 15, 20, 20, you bring the scale. You agree? Loyalty. Liz, I don't understand. You're adored by tens of millions of people. You've been through so much in your life, and you're being asked the question that you could share with us pearls of wisdom, of clarity that you have gleaned yourself of what is love, and when is it real? And this is the statement you tell us? When is love real? Love is the following formula. A recognition of virtue. It's not more complicated than that. I'll repeat myself. Acknowledgement of qualities in the other person is what turns on the love relationship. When we say I love sports, what we're saying is that there are virtues about sports, about playing soccer for example, that I get so much pleasure from. I acknowledge those virtues, I get a great workout, teamship, I enjoy winning. Whatever virtues you find and acknowledge, that is the formula, it's not complicated. Acknowledgement of virtue equals the emotion we call love. Love is not really an emotion. The emotion we call love is the result of a simple formula. When I say I love food, the extent to which I can list the virtues of that food is what I mean when I say I love that food. When I love music, I say it's therapeutic value. It calms me down. It opens my mind. Whatever you can find is what's causing the love relationship. The virtues that you acknowledge, that you notice, that you recognize, is what's causing what you and I call love. If this is really true, let's figure the following out. Where would be the greatest love possible? If love is dependent on virtue, where will there be the greatest love relationship? Where there is the most potential for... If it's true that it's acknowledgement of virtue that equals love, then in this formula, where would the greatest possible love, quantitatively and qualitatively, where would that exist? In what type of relationship? Between me and food? How many virtues can you list? I know if it was chocolate, I could be here all night. But how many virtues can I list about my car that I'm in love with? I love my car.
It would be God.
Well, the greatest possible relationship of love would be wherever's the most virtues. You follow? So if we're talking about unlimited virtues, then that's unlimited love. When God created man, he called us Tselem Elohim. Tselem means reflection. Elohim, very important word to translate correctly, because the Christian Bible has mistranslated it, and we borrow that translation in almost every one of our own translations. What does the word El, which is the two-letter root of Elohim, what does El mean? El means direction, too, but what does it mean actually as a verb? El means power. When Laban chased Jacob in chapter 31 of Genesis, Yesh le'el yadi, there's power in my hand, lasot, ra'im machen, to harm you. The word El means power. Elohim is singular or plural? Plural. So what's the correct translation of the word Elohim? Powers. God says he created man, Selem, reflection of unlimited powers. What does that mean? God's got unlimited powers, but what do you mean I'm a reflection of unlimited powers? I can't create a universe. What does that mean?
You're a reflection of God?
How am I a reflection of God? There are unlimited virtues in every human being that are a reflection of God. Compassion, patience, gratitude, understanding, sensitivity, respect, love, loyalty. Whoa! This is a long list of the real virtues that make up the real us. Yes, I look like I'm my body, but that's not the real me. Yes, I have a financial statement on my personal worth. That's not the real me. I might live in a beautiful home, great zip code, postal code, but that's not the real me. Who's the real me? Which virtues have we nurtured in ourselves because we have a capacity of unlimited ability to love, to be kind, to be generous, to be giving, to be forgiving? There's a lady in America, lost her she had two sons, lost her 19-year-old in a tragedy, a car accident, where a truck driver was drunk and had a head-on collision with her son's car. Gone, dead. She falls into depression, pulls herself out, and she starts fighting. What was she fighting? The injustice. That what was this man's prison sentence? Zero. He was drunk, it wasn't his fault. So what did she do? She fell into a very deep depression. And then she pulled herself out and started lobbying in the local state. But guess what happened on the anniversary of her son's death? Her second and only surviving son commits suicide and left a note, there's no justice. And now she fell into a really deep depression. She was literally sitting on a rocking chair back and forth for months and months. Her husband had to force feed her. He kept taking more and more time off work till he lost his job. How's this going to change? Eventually, she snapped out of it and she started lobbying with full force, and she created an organization which is throughout America. It's called MAD. It's Mothers Against Drunken Drivers. That's the letters, MAD. And she's lobbied so that in almost every state in America, every single police car is installed with a video and special equipment that can immediately determine the level of alcohol in someone's breathing. And then she lobbied successfully that there's a serious prison sentence for drunken drivers who killed by accident. She didn't bring back her children from this, but what's the point I'm bringing up? I'm trying to remember. What was I saying just before this? Sorry? Oh. Yeah. Here's where it is amazing. This is the hardest part to swallow of all. What did she next do? She went to the prison of the person that was later convicted for the death of her first son, who had already got off prison and now is being thrown into prison for the reopening of that case. And she says to him, "I forgive you." Now, she can't forgive him for taking the son away, but for the pain she's had. And she said she didn't do it for this man to get off. She did it for herself. What is forgiveness? When we forgive another person for a crime they've done against us, why am I forgiving that person? Is it really to get them off the hook, or is it so I can sleep at night, so I can continue my life, that I don't walk this world with resentment and hatred, anger, bitterness? God created us but selim. We have an unlimited capacity of compassion, forgiveness, love, generosity, appreciation, gratitude. When we say I love someone, what part of the someone am I relating to? Unconditional love. What does that mean? Unconditional means that I am so fixated on the real virtues inherent in this person that even when you mess up in your performance, I don't blind myself from the original virtues that I will not let go of. Your real compassion, your real appreciation, your responsibility, I will not let go of. Here's the point I'm really making. When we marry someone, do they stay the same person? And I mentioned this in the previous, I don't know how many people here from the previous presentation, but when we marry someone, do they stay the same person when we're married? Or they change? I mean the same person, but not... They change. We're not the same person today as we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Do we expect to be the same person today, 10 years from now? No! Of course not. So the person we marry, anyway, ends up not being the same person we stay married to. So what's going to hold the marriage together? Because it's not going to be the similarities and the differences. It's going to be how we respond to the differences. How we respond to the difficulties in the marriage. That's what's really going to hold us together. How strong will I be in not letting go of the real virtues that's the original cause of love in the relationship and the growing love in the relationship? Or will I be fixated not on those virtues but on what bothers me about your character or what I've discovered about you since I married you and now I'm listing what I don't like about you? You hear the problem? Love is acknowledgement of virtue. If that's really true, what will falling out of love be?
Non-acknowledgement.
I'm stopping to acknowledge virtue. And what might I have been replacing that with? Acknowledgement of what?
Vices.
Of your blemishes. Inconsistencies in your character. Flaws in your personality. Do you hear the problem? Love is not an emotion, it's a science. There's a very specific formula. Recognizing the specific virtues, qualities in the other person, especially when we get into the emotional IQ. Love, sensitivity, gratitude, appreciation, respect, honesty, emotional honesty, forgiveness, admission of mistakes. These are what really count in a long-term relationship. Once we identify that and find it in each other, and verbalize it, and keep reminding, that's what I love about you, we are deepening the love more and more. So the greatest possible relationship, besides God, who's got unlimited virtues, which you're right, that's the greatest possible, is in a human relationship. Because as much as I love chocolate, or food, or sports, or culture, or art, as much as I love money, or architecture, or beautiful home, they still have a limit to how many virtues I can really find in them. But a human being is like unlimited virtues coming together. When two people meet, it's not two bodies meeting, it's two unlimited worlds of exploring virtue together. Forgiveness together, for differences that I can't always get along with. Now we can understand, how does God command love? What he's really telling me is I command you to find the reasons that will cause you to love this person. That's what he's commanding you to do. So when I'm upset with you, what God is trying to tell me, don't forget the reasons that will cause you to recognize the real virtues. Don't forget the real virtues. So that the love base, the real foundation of the relationship, doesn't change. So even if I'm upset with your performance right now, or I'm upset about a difference I can't handle right now, and right now I'm really angry, perhaps even, I hate you, guts! At least that's what I'm saying. Even though I may say it, what God is trying to tell me is, don't ever let go of reality. Because reality is, this person is created with unlimited virtue. Selah Melkim, reflection of God's unlimited power. And in that sort, I'm being commanded to look for. Look for the unlimited qualities in this person's personality that will cause me to feel love for them. So when God says, love me, he's commanding me to look for the reasons that will cause me to love him. To count the kindnesses he does for me every day. So that even if, God forbid, there's a fault in my physique, something goes wrong in one area of my physical body, I still have all the other areas that are functioning to be grateful for. I had a friend who was diagnosed with cancer, but when his doctor told him he had 6 months to live, but when he couldn't pay the bill, the doctor gave him another 6 months. Why are you laughing? Oh, God, joking. Okay. When things go wrong, they are opportunities for me to acknowledge all the time things were going right. There's a young lady, Sandra, who she went off to college and hadn't communicated with mum and dad for quite a while. Finally, they receive a letter, and it goes like this. Dear mum and dad, please do not continue reading this letter until you're sitting in a very comfortable couch. Oh no, what's Sandra done this time? Dear mum and dad, I'm sorry I haven't written to you for 3 months. There was a fire in my apartment, and there was no way for me to get out except throw myself through the window. And I fractured my skull, I broke both my legs. Mum and dad, you know, the gas attendant across the street was such a kind man. When he saw, he heard the shattering glass, he called the fire brigade, he called the ambulance. Mum and dad, if it wasn't for him, I would not be writing this letter to you. He saved my life. You know, they took me to the ICU. I was in intensive care for 3 weeks. And mum and dad, I was in a coma. And this man was so good, he brought chocolates and flowers every day, would speak to me. I couldn't respond, I was in a coma, but I heard every word. He's giving me words of hope and encouragement. Mum and dad, he was so kind that when they discharged me, my memory was not all there. I just couldn't remember where I lived, and my apartment anyway was all fired out. Mum and dad, he was so kind, he took me into his apartment. Mum and dad, he's got a slight disease in his blood, which I caught a little bit of, but I want to invite you to our wedding before the pregnancy shows up. Lots of love, Sandra. Now, if you're mum and dad and you didn't get heart attack before the PS went like this. Mum and dad, there was no fire in my apartment. I did not throw myself out the window. I haven't got a fractured skull. I didn't break both my legs. There was no gas attendant. I was not in the ICU. And mum and dad, I do not have a dangerous disease and I'm not pregnant. But mum and dad! Oldfield cursed me! But I want to put it in perspective. whatever goes wrong in our lives is never as much as what could go wrong in our lives. Whatever's wrong with my health, it could be a whole lot worse. Whatever's wrong in our wealth could be a whole lot worse. Whatever's wrong in the relationship with this child could be a whole lot worse. When God allows, so to speak, for things to happen that is not to my favor, he's not trying to hurt me. He's trying to help me have the power of contrast so that I wake up and notice all the time I had it good. Love is acknowledgement of virtue. And sometimes, when it's removed a little bit, helps me get back into what's really important. I mentioned, forgive me if I'm repeating myself, it was I mentioned talking to Christopher Reeve. Did I mention that the other night? Okay, I apologize. So I want to share with you, about 5 years ago, Motzei Yom Kippur, there was an opportunity to meet with Christopher Reeve. So I went along with a friend. He was wheeled onto a platform. Here's Superman, reduced to a quadriplegic. He's paralyzed from the neck down. And the first words that came out of his mouth were, I've never been more happy in my life than since my accident. I mean, come on, you're an actor. How can you get away with a statement like that? It's unbelievable. How can you be more happy? Paralyzed from the neck down. The only two parts of his entire body that moved were his eyes and his mouth. And he explained to justify what he meant by that. I've never been more happy in my life than since my accident because I discovered the real me. He said, the real me is not my body. If God only left me with my brain and my heart, I could still choose to be happy. He said, the real me is not the tens of millions of dollars I've made. The real me is not the many homes I own. The real me is not even the half a million fan mail I've received since my accident. He said, the real me is when my wife smiles at me and I smile back. That's amazing. What does that mean? When we smile at each other, what do we mean by that smile? What are we actually saying with that smile? Honestly, what are we saying with the smile? For those still awake. What does a smile say?
You're glad you're in your life.
I'm happy you're in my life. I'm happy you exist in my life. You see, the whole concept of existence of you in my life. And when I say you, what do I mean by you? The whole you. Including your shape, which I might not always be enamored by. Your wardrobe, I might not agree to your taste. The whole you, all your virtues. Including your inconsistencies, including your difficulties, your own challenges. When we say we're smiling, we are saying a very powerful statement without having yet opened up our mouths. We're saying, I'm happy you exist in my life. I'm accepting you as you are. I love you as you are. If you improve, that's bonus. But I still love the real you. He then mentioned something very powerful. He said, when he asked his wife after the first couple of years going in and out of depression, said for 4 years he was in and out of depression, till he came to this conclusion and held it, that life is all about who I'm becoming inside of me. He said to his wife after the first 2 years of depression, going in and out of depression, he said, why do you still love me? You can't perform as a husband. It's a quadriplegic. Isn't it a liability? Not an asset. And his wife said a very powerful, simple response that he wrote his autobiography based on that response. When he asked her, why do you still love me? Her answer was, because you're still you. The real you is still you. You haven't changed. Your body's not the same body, but the real you has become better. You're more loving and sending, much more generous. You're much more clear about what really counts in life. He admitted his relationship with his ex-wife and his children from that marriage and his second marriage has exponentially grown since his accident. And he wrote a book called Still Me, a pun on his physical condition. But the real me is much greater. I would even suggest he was never a superman in his lifetime, but he died a superhuman being, an amazing person who reached this clarity. In Hebrew, how do we say love? Ava. What's the three-letter root? Ohev. Three letters. Aleph, Hey, Vase. This language is not an arbitrary language. We claim God created the universe with this language, which means that this language dictated and still dictates reality. That the letters in Hebrew for love are not arbitrary letters. If we understand their meaning, we will understand the mechanic that creates the emotion we call love. The letter Aleph means one. The letter Bet means two. Is that right? The letter Hey. You know, one of the ways to know the meaning of a letter, our sages tell us, the Vilna Gaon explains this based on a Talmud in Bava Kamma, page 55, which describes how the first time a letter appears in the Torah, at the beginning of a word, the first time a letter appears at the beginning of a word in the Torah, that word is the essence of that letter. What is the first time, which word does the letter Hey appear in for the first time at the beginning of that word? So I'll help you along. It's in the word Hayah, Haysa. What does Hayah mean? Translates as? Well, Hayah is life, but Hayah with a Hey. Was. And explain in another word in English. What does was mean? That's a prefix. That's not the beginning of the word. Do you understand? The base in Bereshis is not the first letter of that word, because the base there is the prefix. The Hey is in Hashemayim is the prefix. The prefix is not part of the word. It's fixed onto. Right? So the letter Hey, the first time it appears in the beginning of the word, as part of the word, is in the word Haita, which means was or exists. You follow? The word was is a translation. It really means existence, whether past, present, or future. You follow? The greatest compliment we can pay another person is to admit, acknowledge their existence in my life. And what is the existence that I'm referring to? Their physical existence, that's one level. The shape of their body, that's another level. Their choice of clothes is another level. All the physical items that surround them in their life is another level. But if I really want to get to what is it that I am happy that exists in my life, in you, we talk about the real virtues inside that person. The word Ahava in Hebrew, Ohev, is Aleph, one, Hey, recognizing existence, Bet, of a second person. But the letter Bet, what does it mean in Hebrew? Spell it out. What does Bayit mean? I need some Israelis here. What does Bayit actually mean? Home, thank you. What's the difference between a house and a home? House is the outside, the physical structure. What is a home? It's the people inside, their dynamic, which makes up the home. How we respond to each other, how we get along, how we don't get along. Someone once asked me for my definition of a dysfunctional family. I said, that's easy. The definition of a dysfunctional family is any family with more than one member. The letter bet literally means bayit. Bayit means inside. When God told Noah to build the ark and cover it with kofar, with pitch, he said, cover it, mi bayit, from inside, from mechutz, and outside. Bayit means inside. The letter bet as a prefix means what? In. So look again at this word, love. Aleph, one person, hey, recognizing the existence, bet of the inside of another person. Real love is not just one recognizing the existence of another. That's one surface level, that's the physical level. But the real love is when I recognize the true virtues that make up your Tselem Elokim, the fact that you are a reflection of your Almighty Creator. But it doesn't stop there. Because if the first letter, the first time it appears in the Torah, at the beginning of the word is the essence of that letter, where's the first time the Aleph in the word Ava, love, where's the first time the letter Aleph appears in the Torah, at the beginning of the word?
Elokim.
Elokim means the all-powerful. Hey means acknowledging the existence. Bet, the first time the letter bet appears in the Torah, at the beginning of the word, not as a prefix, is in the word bara, in creation. God gives existence to creation. God is constantly doing unlimited acts of kindness in our lives that clearly demonstrates He loves creation. He loves us. He's always giving. The two-letter root of Ava is giving. And what type of giving? Hav means giving. But what type of giving? Not just physical giving. Emotional giving. Emotional support. Especially when you foul up and I don't quickly judge you. Oh, now there's a chance for real endearment. But if I say, I knew you would do that, you know, it's so typical of you, and I start going through a whole charade of all my complaints about you, you're not going to feel good about yourself, you're not going to feel good about me. You will not be endeared to me. We can hurt each other so much with our anger and put downs and sharp words and criticism, and at the same time, if I give you a second chance and a third chance and a fourth chance, just like my Creator does for me, and I'm patient, understanding, considerate, sensitive, loving, giving, generous, being done the hafzut, judging favorably, that's where real love kicks in. There's much more to be said on the subject, but I'll really close on the following. Life is not about me finding me. Life is really about me creating me. I'm not here to find me, I'm here to create me. And all the people in my life are here to help me create myself. Because what they do when they squeeze me, and some people squeeze real tight, when they squeeze me, it's not God trying to hurt me because, oh, I'm in such a difficult marriage, or I've been single so long, or I've got this kid who is driving me nuts. I cannot believe I'm suffering so much from this child. Drives me nuts. As much as I want to blame and complain that it's people and circumstances that are hurting me, God is not in the business of hurting. He's in the business of helping me create the only person I'm here to create by sending different and difficult people to squeeze me. And what comes out when I'm squeezed? Whatever's inside. If I'm frustrated, if I'm angry, if I'm resentful and bitter, when you squeeze me, what's going to come out? The anger, the bitterness, the resentment. If I'm about searching for virtue in myself and in others, if I'm about looking to love, appreciate, give, be generous, be considerate, sensitive, concerned, if I'm about looking for virtue and I get squeezed, what's going to come out? God wants us to get squeezed for me to see what comes out. Not for you, it's for me to see whether I want to continue that way. God is here to help me by sending different and difficult people and circumstances to not shape me. People don't shape us. Circumstances, our school, our education doesn't shape us. They help reveal us to ourselves. God is in the business of squeezing us for me to see what comes out, to reveal to me what's inside. So I get to choose, do I want to continue damning, condemning, blaming, accusing, excusing, denying, complaining, hurting, criticizing, using sharp words, sarcasm, or do I feel better about myself when I'm loving about myself, compassionate about myself, and of those around me? Hashem doesn't give up, so that every time I get impatient with the very person I'm asking, God, please, I beg you, this woman, she's driving me nuts! Give me patience, please! Guess who God sends in 3 seconds later? That's the person I'm talking about! questions. He's answering my request. Help me change the only person I'm in this world to change. And so God sends difficult and different children and parents and spouses and mothers and laws to help me change the only person I was created to change. Love is finding virtue in my creator, in myself, and in others. That is the command. To look for reasons that will cause me to love my creator, other people, and myself. I will close. I'm going to truly mean it. Three mothers on Broadway. That's in Florida. They're congregating there. Let's say Bournemouth. Makes it easy for locally. And they're boasting how much their son shows them respect on their birthday. Mrs. Koshleski is boasting to Mrs. Horowitz, is boasting to Mrs. Cohen. You thought I'd tell you what my son does to me on my birthday? You thought I'd know. I tell you anything. My son on my birthday. Ah, I get to knock on the door. I open the door. And there's my son, 6'4", giving me a hug, destroying my face. He says, happy birthday, mom. I says, thank you, darling. And I look at the end of the driveway, and there they have a stretch limo. How they stretch it so far. And he takes me to the most expensive kosher restaurant. And there I'm waiting for me, all my friends and family, and a birthday party, just my son loves me so much. How do you want to show you respect on your birthday? Oh, you don't want to know. I tell you. My son on my birthday, he takes me to Heathrow Airport, and there he charters the Concorde. And he puts me on the Concorde. 2 hours, 57 minutes later, I arrive in New York. And there, he taxes me to the most expensive hotel in Square. And there, waiting for me, all my friends and family from the whole world. We had a weekend party just for my house. It's over my birthday. And both mothers turn to Mrs. Cohen, who everyone knows has zero relationship with her son. They haven't been speaking for years. And Mrs. Cohen, how does your son show you respect on your birthday? Oh, birthday, birthday, respect, respect. My son doesn't have to wait for no birthday to show me respect. My son pays £200 an hour to his therapist 5 times a week, and all he talks about is me. I could spend my whole life complaining and analyzing for a long time how this person, my mother, my father, my spouse, my ex, my brother, my sister, my mother, my father, my hurts me, and I can list all my complaints about what I don't like about them. But God put me in this world that if I'm going to play that game, if I'm going to play the game of acknowledging what I don't like about you, I should at least be consistent with my own logic and acknowledge what I like about you. That's the command. God wants me to let go of things that have hurt me and replace them with compassion, as hard as it is. But that's the miracle that God wants me to do. His miracles don't compare to the greatest miracle of all. When a human being changes their nature, that impresses God the most. He switches nature all the time. He's playing, manipulating, opening seas, revealing himself at Sinai, creating the universe, keeping it going, but that doesn't compare. Those miracles are God's miracles. Wonderful, they impress us. But what would impress God? When we change ourselves. Oh, that's the greatest miracle of all. Changing my nature, turning myself around to become more loving, even in the relationship I have now, with the complaints and the inconsistencies that I don't like, I start a new campaign to list for myself and for you the virtues that are real because you were created, but seldom with the image of our Creator. Thank you for your patience.